There are many things to see when looking in and out into the world, and one of them, I believe, is that the human species is growing up. Marianne Benson writes in her book, Neuroaffective Meditation, about conscious maturation. I'm Robin with Tributaries. Stay tuned. As you write in your book and toward the end of your book, there are no other peacemakers than us. I just thought that would be a good place to start because it's certainly the reason why you are doing what you're doing, I would imagine, and writing these wonderful books.
Yeah, that's true. And right now, of course, with the war that's happening, the invasion that's happening in Ukraine, it's a very very intense concern here in Denmark, which is, you know, not very far away from Ukraine. So we've kind of followed that process, and it's so clear how difficult it is to hold peace and to be a peacekeeper. And to not have two things, one of two things happen. One is the escalation that we're seeing. And the other thing that happens is that we are bombarded with information 24/7. There's nothing else on the radio. I haven't seen the TV, but I assume it's the same. And it made me think about a keynote I did 2 days after 9/11. And what was clear then seems clear now, which is that when we are bombarded with that, with information 24/7 like that, a traumatic response starts in each of us. So there's this, and that doesn't help in terms of deepening or clarifying our sense of what needs to happen, or how we could downregulate out of this kind of situation. So it's a very poignant time to remember the sense of the peacekeeper and start to wonder, how could we do that? How could we support peace?
Yes, and it is a subtle experience when we are bombarded 24/7, as you say. Let me ask you, your book is Neuroaffective Meditation, A Practical Guide to Lifelong Brain Development, Emotional Growth, and Healing Trauma. Can you begin by giving us an example of what is in neuroaffective training? or define it, whatever you wish.
Something about what is neuroaffective training. Yeah, well, I think that the first point to get is neuroaffective. What is neuroaffective anyhow? And what it is an original, you might say, separation from neurocognitive. For many, many decades, neurocognitive work was the only kind of research that was done on the brain. And since I'm a psychotherapist and my dear friend and colleague Susan Hart is a psychologist, and we've been working with adults primarily, and she with children with really severe difficulties in their lives, it's been obviously really interesting for us to look at the emotional development. And that is what neuroaffective is about. So when we got into the 90s, which was the decade of the brain, then we started seeing this explosion of research happening on the emotional dynamics of the brain that is still ongoing, and the development of the brain, no less. So what we know today, for instance, is that absolutely essential things happen in the first period of life from before birth, when the nervous system starts to mature at around the sixth or seventh month in utero. And then we are actually start to synchronize with our parents and continue to do that, to work with synchronization until we're about 3 months after birth old. That was a poor excuse for a sentence, but you got what I meant, I think. And after that, we start to, out of that synchronization and that sense of safety, we start to develop the capacity for emotional interaction. In other words, a sense of comfort and discomfort starts to differentiate into feelings. And when we're about 1 year old, we start to develop more cognitive skills. 10 months, 1 year, thereabouts, we start to develop the sense of cognitive dynamics and memory capacity starts to emerge and things like that. So we have this graded development of the brain, and the brain actually continues to organize and reorganize itself all the way through life. But at the moment, we are the main thinking about the development of the brain is that we have a fairly fully developed brain somewhere around the age of 27, 28 years. And that's interesting, partly because some parts of the brain have been deteriorating for a while by then. So there is no area of the brain that is actually, there's no time when you can say that everything in the brain is mature now, because some things have stopped working by the time other things are maturing. And that's part of the interest, I think, the interesting point about the neuroaffective development is this discovery of these different emotional highlights or high points that we can catch and that we can work with at different ages.
Yes, well, it's interesting what you're saying about the brain, how some parts are on their way out and others are still developing. How do you see that? Is it something that someone in your realm of study would say, oh, yes, we don't need that anymore, and so something else is taking over? Or what actually is stopping growth early on in the 20s that, or before perhaps? And do you see that as something as humans we just haven't gotten a handle on yet? And perhaps we're on our way with the study of emotions and bringing all of these other factors into the cognitive?
I think that there are certain things, in a certain sense, stopping development on certain points means that you can start to focus on other points. So if we take an example that most people know, when you're about 12 years old, your ability to learn languages really, really easily starts to go away. And when you're in your 30s, if you want to learn a new language, you usually have to put quite a bit of work into it. Now, this is because your capacity to learn languages basically shuts down. And every time we see one of these shutdown dynamics happening, we see maturation in another place. So one of the things we can say is that we probably can't have everything open at the same time. If we look at, for instance, a two-month-old baby, this baby is incredibly engaged in looking and imitating. And at some point in time, typically around two and a half months, the baby starts to get a little bit bored just of imitation, and it starts to invent new things. So some children and also some adults still need the imitative process to be able to develop to a point of being able to feel safe. But once they feel safe, we don't need to keep on helping them to feel more safe. Then they start to need other things. Does that make sense?
Oh, yes, it does. And it just sort of leads me in the direction of the neuroplasticity that's certainly fairly well known now and is being developed further as far as study and research goes. Does that fit in anywhere? Is that something where the neuroplasticity could be worked on and then, boom, at 35, you're able to learn a language?
We don't know that yet. What we do know is that that immersion is likely to help you. What we also know is that if you already know about five languages, the number six is much easier to pick up. But most of us don't know five languages by the age of 20. Of course, some people do. So, yeah. So I don't think that's a known dynamic. There are different pieces of research on neuroplasticity, but I haven't been following them very closely. Perhaps largely because I've been seeing people among others. I've been looking at work done with people that have really early disturbances and have been disturbed for large periods of their early development, and they have very little neuroplasticity. It's very difficult to learn because the in a way they're still their nervous system is still at the level of needing this capacity to imitate and create a basic safe sense. And at the same time, they have a self belief system that is in a very, very different place, that is engaged in the things that people are engaged in talking about stuff and going places and listening to music and things like that. So it's part of that mystery of how do we understand ourselves, which is one issue, and on the other side, where are we actually? Because a large part of our consciousness is nonverbal. It has no words.
So when you're working neuroaffectively, you are gathering or becoming more aware of the interconnectedness of the sensory and the emotional growth and healing trauma. Do you always come in through that emotional window, or does it differ for each person you're working with or situation?
It would differ for each person I'm working with. It depends on where they feel comfortable. You always have to start with working with people where they are. And sometimes that's very close to where we need to go to work with an issue. And sometimes it's very far away. So when it's very far away, which it is with some people because they're in a very cognitive space, if we start there, then we can do a little dip into an emotional or an autonomic, so a sensory or an emotional space. And then having done that, we have to go back up and process that cognitively, because if we don't do that, it will be too scary. It has to, every little step has to integrate into the known world, into the known world of the person that I'm working with.
Yes. Now, so when you're working with someone, you bring in the mindfulness, obviously, and you write that the main function of mindfulness in psychotherapy is not to teach meditation. What do you look at as far as the full range of mindfulness goes? And then what is that function? How does that help move in and through these other emotional or affective situations?
I think that the primary function of mindfulness in psychotherapy, in fact, is to develop the mindfulness of the therapist. And I think that that has a number of benefits. And the first one of those is that mindfulness, it's really a terrible term, you know, mindfulness, because it's, in a way, it relates us back to the mind. And
right.
In the West, it relates us back to thinking.
Yes.
But
no.
Really, it's a heartfelt process.
Yes.
And that's what it does. It opens one's capacity to hold the other person in one's heart, and that's essential, I think, for healing. And it's also essential for not giving the other person something that they cannot use. So, and that's also one of the reasons to not necessarily teach meditation, although many of the people that I've worked with over the years have insisted on learning meditation and have also insisted on learning it from me, so which is why the book finally came out, because somebody also insisted on that.
Yeah. Well, it seems that the mindfulness really is allowing that space that can't be very well defined, and I'm sure you could speak about it much better than I, but it's allowing for a place that never existed before when you're working with a client. And once they have that new playground, then the possibilities really do exist so much stronger for change, don't they?
New doors. You discover that there are new doors. And the beauty of neuroaffective development is that there's actually a sequence to the doors. In much the same way as nowadays, and for a long time, we've known that you can test a child, for instance, and you can see whether the child's actually ready to start school or start second grade or start fifth grade. But you can do the same thing with neuroaffective development. You can see where is there a stability. Okay, there's stability at the autonomic level, so we can work at the emotional level. At the emotional level, there are very specific steps. There's a step of even knowing different kinds of feeling and being able to have them in a relationship with another and develop and redevelop a sense of safety, of attuning with another human being, and also having faults happen, having mistakes happen, having unpleasant things happen. And from that point, being able to reestablish a relationship so that it feels as strong or stronger than it did before. Once you've established that, you're well on your way to creating a secure attachment relationship. When you have a secure attachment relationship, then you can start to work with symbols and you can start to work with self-control issues, being able to determine how much you eat or drink or whether you actually go for the walk that you promised yourself that you were going to go for. And after that, you can start to work on mentalization, the ability to understand what you yourself and what other people are doing and why they're doing it. Which is, again, where the heart qualities come in. The heart qualities keep opening through this process again.
You cover many aspects of the many directions of maturity. And could you share something about the neurology of maturation and how it might dovetail or draw together with biological maturation? The biology is something that also seems to go in and out of vogue and seems to be more in vogue these days. Please correct me if I'm wrong.
No, I think you're right. I mean, obviously that things go in and out of vogue, and also that this is somewhat in vogue at the moment. I think that one of the interesting things about maturation of the brain is that the very, very sharp linear learning process that is part of the left dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, if anybody wants to know the name of it. But there's a certain part of the brain that's very much engaged in learning things in sequences. And this part of the brain is at its highest function in the mid to late 20s. And then it starts to be less and less active. And that happens basically for the rest of our lives. And when that happens, another part of the brain, which is much more emotional, which is the right part of the brain as it happens, and which was also the more active part up until we were maybe three or 4 years old, that part of the brain gains ascendancy. And as that happens, we start to use more and more of the brain to look at the same issue that we only used the left part of the brain for when we were in our mid-20s. So what does that do is the question. And the answer is that what it seems to do is that instead of looking at things in a very linear fashion, but also sort of losing a lot of stuff around the edges, we have a much more holistic view. So for instance, as a psychotherapist, I noticed that when I was in my 40s or 50s, the best way that I could approach an issue started to be just to look at a person and just let whatever came to the front of my awareness, to let that be the issue that I was thinking of. And after that, of course, I would test that, see whether that also worked for the other person. But this intuitive sense of grasping the essence of what you're looking at is really part of that. And that is part of the aging process. And it has to do with that dynamic function of having both parts of the brain engaged at the same time.
maybe it's difficult to go back in time to see how things were, but the industrial age, for instance, I think mm-hmm. brought more of the mechanical or mechanistic type of linear thinking. And
yeah.
and yay, you know, it helped yeah. all this great technology and scientific theory or thought or discovery.
Yeah.
And now I feel like we are entering a new age, and I almost feel like saying, okay, science, thank you. See you later. You know, and
see you later, yeah.
We can't get rid of science, nor am I really truly suggesting it, although I'd like to like take the foot off the pedal a little bit and allow for these other things, this nonlinear, yeah. because it's a trend, right? I mean, it definitely is a trend, and you can take something so far before you do have to start reincorporating the whole.
Yeah, that's true. I think that I forgot a part because you were talking about the biological. I think the evolutionary is part of that. And just as one of the things that evolutionary biologists have puzzled over is why do women have menopause? And so they started looking at other animals, mammals that have menopause. And one of the creatures that does that is I think it's a great gray whale. It's one of the great whales anyhow. And what they find is that it means that you have grandmothers, and grandmothers can pass on cultural information. So it looks like there's an evolutionary wisdom selection that goes with that, which is interesting because that is also what we get from this way of seeing the world, which is more common as we grow older, obviously. So I'm in my 60s now, and it's very clear that the best thing I can do if I want to prepare for something is to kind of look at all the information and then go for a walk. In my 20s, I spent hours at my desk thinking about, you know, what to do and what steps.
Yeah. And of course, a lot of the knowledge of the steps that you would take was new. So you had to really sort of ingrain that into what was going on for you, right?
That's it.
So in your book, Neuroaffective Meditation, you mentioned earlier that you were asked to write this book. And mm-hmm. how did you kind of, once you said, okay, I am going to do this, what was your discovery process like as far as what you really wanted to share and connect to with other people about?
Hmm. Well, I think that there were a number of things, really. One was that I knew that I wanted to do both write down some meditations for people that like to read. And I also knew that I wanted to do some online meditations for people that don't like to read, but that like to listen. So that was certainly one part of it. And I knew that I wanted to connect it to this sense of the in a way, the three waves of development that we go through as human beings. The first one is up to 2 or 3 years. The second one is up to 20 or 30 years. And the third one is when we die. So we have these three different processes that go on in our lives. And I just wanted to get those in there and to relate some of the maturation that you can see in that process with the sense of wisdom dynamics, and actually to relate that also to some of the processes of meditation, of what meditation can offer us. So in a way, it's linking meditation to the understanding of how we can mature as human beings, that it's a level of maturation, because it allows us when we don't think it can do everything, which it may be able to do for some people, but it couldn't do everything for me, and it can't do everything for a lot of other people I know. But it can do certain things, and some of the things it really can do is it can open this sense of releasing ourselves. It can open this sense of being a part of the world instead of being a separate creature, which is something that our societies have strengthened the separateness of us for so many decades, and to rediscover that we're not just in the world as individuals, but we are part of the world and emerged out of the world and will be swallowed again into the world. So, and in the meantime, we are held and surrounded and cared for and fed by the world. So it's this this sense of belonging, like a leaf belongs in on a tree, that I also wanted to bring to people, and also to take off some of the enormous stress that people feel around what they should be able to do well in circles that I move in. You know, women will plan a birth, and if the birth doesn't go the way they had expected, it will be a great letdown. And if the relationship doesn't go as it's expected, or the job doesn't go as it's expected, and these days it's even the death, you know, if you don't die in the appropriate way, then in some ways you feel as if you should be dying in the right way, and if you don't, it's not, it becomes a stressor. I want to reduce some of that stress and use meditation to realize that in fact we're not in control. In fact, life is messy, and life happens in strange and mysterious ways, and that we are resting in it more than we are agents that can steer it in the right direction always.
Yes, Marianne, very well said. Is there a meditation that you could not necessarily do with us right now, but suggest?
The way that I always start my meditations, and you can actually find a number of them that I did for the Dutch people. I was asked to do a series of meditations when the coronavirus started, and they're accessible on my homepage. And my homepage is mariannabenson.com. And I always have people start by stretching. So the first thing you can do is stretch and see if you can find a yawn or 5 or 6 or 10. And get in touch with your body and notice areas that you haven't been noticing. And then you can look around and see if there's something in your visual field that your eyes like to look at. And then you can notice your breathing. See if your breathing will relax a bit more, just settling into it, like we breathe at the end of a long day, that breath.
Is there anything you would like to weave in?
Yeah, at the end of the book, I suddenly realized that I wanted to put in that when we look at this aspect of meditation as one of the ways that we can mature into the higher levels of the nonverbal instead of the baby levels of the nonverbal, which babies have, right?
Yes.
If we want to mature into those, we use meditation. And that brings us to, in a way, balancing three levels of responsibility. The first level is always for ourselves and for physical bodies and our world and our children and our buildings and our how we live and our work and all that. So that personal responsibility. And the second is for our societies and the world around us, the interactions, but also how we treat the world as such. And the third one is for our relationship to spirit and this silent, ongoing communication that spirit has with us and that we can open our ears to and have with spirit. I like that. That's like the whole burger, as it were.
Yes, agreed. That's the epitome of maturation.
Yeah, it is.
Many thanks to Marianne Benson. Her book is Neuroaffective Meditation. For anything tributaries related, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. Our podcasts are in the usual spots. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.